Sorry. Well, thank you. Wow. It's been a long time since I was here, and I appreciate the microphone. I don't have to talk loud tonight. This is nice. I'll just kind of be nice and quiet. Last time I was here was with Guna Kumar, I think. Y'all still remember Guna Kumar, our friend in India? So I'm sorry if some of you may have lost touch with Guna. I'm going to make sure you get reconnected to him. But when COVID hit 3 years ago now, it stopped a lot of things from happening. And one of the terrible things that happened is that his son, Joel, we called him, who was his right hand in ministry and was going to be the ministry over the next 30 years, got COVID and died. I got the message to please pray. You know, they were having all-night prayer meetings, and they were doing everything possible to hope that he would recover. And honestly, I never dreamed he would die. I just thought he's 41 years old. He'll be fine, you know, so I will pray. But he left behind a beautiful wife and two beautiful children. And so life is hard over there. So when you think about Guna, pray for India. Man, all of a sudden, I'm getting sad. I didn't mean to come here and be sad tonight. But then we basically, through Fishhook International, we support two primary people, Guna being one of them. The other one is a guy named Richard Samuel. I don't know if anybody here remembers Richard. I don't think he came here. Maybe he did one time. But same thing. Richard's in his 50s. He has five children, a son, and four daughters. And his son was the oldest child, and we were so close that he named his son Timmy after me. So Timmy was always real special to me. Timmy, I tried to teach Timmy how to play golf, and it didn't quite work out. He became a piano player and a very gifted musician. And when he was 21 years old, two years ago, he died. Very tragic death. Both of them only had one son. And all of a sudden, both of them have had to live the last 2 years in this scenario of my only son is gone. Well, that rings a bell, doesn't it, for church and for sermons. God understands losing an only son. And just that kind of language, in fact, the fact that we're talking about sons and fathers is family stuff. Church is family. Am I right about that? You're not really just a church here. I hope you don't think of yourself that way, but this is all about family. So thank you for asking about Guna, and I'm going to make sure that you all get reconnected to him. He's doing fine, really. He's in and out of the hospital himself sometimes. He's gotten older. He's even older than me a little bit, but I'm here tonight. Larry asked me to talk about marriage, so I'm the least qualified guy to do this in the history of the world in many ways. I'm not going to help you a whole lot in terms of a marriage tune-up. I will say this to get us started. On June 28th, what's today, June the 10th, 9th? 19 days from now, you all have the honor to celebrate the 70th anniversary of Larry McDowell and Bonnie Jo McDowell got married 70 years ago. Larry, what was she thinking? We talked about this today, you know, and he told me he was thinking about maybe just walking away. He told me, he says, enough is enough. But you know, Larry, but what a great couple. I mean, I know you don't want me to brag on you, but Larry and I have been friends for 40 years. I'm sure there's some people sitting here tonight that are here because of Larry and Bonnie Jo. I'm sure I'm not the only one. And typical of them, you'll get a kick out of this. I'll tell this little quick story. I was at their house last night, and I said, What's your Wi-Fi password? I need to get onto my phone and my internet. What's your password? Well, Bonnie Jo just kind of looked at me. She said, well, I think it's Jesus. Jesus? I've never heard of such a password as Jesus. So I got on there and I tried to make Jesus work, but it didn't work. Right, Bonnie Jo? So she says, well, let me go back. And she looked and she found a number and I plugged the number in. So I got on the Wi-Fi with the number she gave me. But I thought, this is a perfect illustration of Larry and Bonnie Jo. It doesn't matter what the question is. They think the answer is Jesus. What's the password? Jesus. Anyway, Bonnie Jo, it's not Jesus. It's something else. So... but they've been following Jesus. So I've got my Bible here, but don't worry, I'm not going to preach a sermon. And I did make a few notes, though, and I have to, Sue can tell you that I have to somewhat apologize because I haven't really talked about marriage for quite a long time. And that's because I spent 14 years in family court as a judge. Then, while I was doing that, I wrote this book, and I did not bring any book. I should have brought some books to sell, but I didn't. So you're going to have to go on Amazon if you want one of these books. It's called Judge Z. This is about a family court judge who was sort of like me, okay? This was a crazy judge who was trying to slow down divorces and is in the process of learning what it means, what marriage means. Judge Z, the subtitle is Irretrievably Broken. And I will talk about that in just a few minutes. But so I used to talk about this a lot. I could spend 3 days. We could do this for 12 hours if you want to thoroughly discuss the history of marriage and the history of divorce and what it all means. But we're not going to spend 3 days. Sue doesn't want to spend 3 days, no. We're going to give you the 35 or 40 minute version so we can get to the dessert. But bottom line is, I'm the least qualified guy to know much about marriage. Other than this, Sue and I have been married for almost 52 years. And so we're a little bit of an expert on that. But in 2003, I was leaving 7 years as president of CBMC International, where I traveled and preached and spoke and was basically a full-time evangelist, really. And I asked the Lord as I resigned and was going back to Lexington, Kentucky, where we're from, with the idea to just be a lawyer again. I love being a lawyer. And so I asked the Lord, I put it in my journal, in fact, Lord, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I says, please put me in the middle of the mess. When I wrote those words, I had never heard of family court. I had left my legal profession for 7 years, had gone off and traveled the world, and now we're going back home. And I didn't know there was such a thing as family court, even though I had been a lawyer for over 20 years. The governor of Kentucky turned out to be a friend of mine, and there was an opening for this position in family court. And he appointed me. He called me. Would you like to be? Well, I was unemployed, so I would have taken any job. And I took this position as a judge in family court. I then won the election the next year. But family court became my home for more than 14 years. Every single day. Divorces. Neglect and abuse cases. Domestic violence. Family court. Family, of course, Psalm 68:6, God puts the lonely in families. God's main answer for the problems of the world is a family. And yet we've messed up families so much that now in America we now have specialty courts for families called family court. So for instance, where we lived in Kentucky, there were 9 circuit judges. 4 of the 9 circuit judges did nothing but family court. That was me. I was one of those 4 judges. And we stayed busier than the other judges. So the truth is, 1/2 of all the litigation in our county was family stuff. So it turns out family's not the answer in our culture. Family's the problem. And so I got the privilege, really. You talk about being in the middle of the mess. All the divorces, all the domestic violence, all the neglect cases. And so I was very happy in family court. It was a good fit for me. There's no juries in family court, so I got to decide every case the way I thought it should be decided, and thoroughly enjoyed the whole process. But after being there for about 8 or 9 years, I started to see some things. And because of a couple of things happening, I began to start thinking in my mind, I think I want to write this book. But the book that I wanted to write was actually going to be a scholarly work that would define marriage. What is marriage? Now, if we were doing a full-blown seminar tonight, I would have everybody a card, and I would say, just take 1 minute and write out your definition. What is marriage? And when I ask that question, everybody gets nervous because nobody knows what it is. Marriage. I know I am married, or I used to be married, or I'm not married. By the way, if you're divorced, I didn't come here tonight to make you feel guilty. If you're single, I didn't come here to make you sad. I'm just here to tell you marriage is important. That's really all I'm trying to do. Marriage matters more than you probably think it does. But nobody could answer that question. What is marriage? I ask over 100 people, what's marriage? This is all the way from PhDs that teach theology down to waitresses in Denny's. What is marriage? And everybody just kind of looks at me like, I don't know. So I read every book you can read on marriage. I read The History of Marriage, a 700-page book on the history of marriage. I became an expert on marriage. And then, of course, I also did it because I heard this too many times. My main ministry has been with men in smaller groups. A lot of that is thanks to Larry McDowell, who encouraged me and got me going. And so many times I would say, how you doing, Joe? And Joe would say, oh, everything's great. Everything's good at work. Everything is good at church. My small group is going really good. Everything's good with my golf game. The family's good. I only got one problem. Oh, really? And then they would kind of lean in and whisper, well, what's your one problem? Well, my marriage. I started to realize, like, almost nobody's got a good marriage. Almost nobody. So, and I realized that these people that were telling me this were sort of being phonies in a sense, because if somebody asks you how you're doing, if your marriage is going bad, your answer should be, I'm doing terrible. I'm making plenty of money, and my church stuff is going pretty good, and the kids are doing okay, but because of that marriage thing, it influences everything. I don't want to go home at night. It changes everything. So marriage is so much more important than we want it to be. Then at that time, as I'm beginning to write the book, the same-sex marriage thing's happening too. So I'm watching just enough news to know nobody's got any good answers. And every time I'm watching the TV, whether it's a preacher or some politician, and they're trying to explain why same-sex marriage should not be legal, I'm sitting there going, I could do such a better job explaining this than this guy. I mean, the people on my side of this thing are so stupid. They're all wrong about this whole thing. And part of that is because, now listen to me, I say it in the book, and it's true, the greatest tragedy is not that gay people want to get married. As crazy as that is, the greatest tragedy is that straight people don't want to get married. And so about 90% of the people in family court are not married. Did you know that? They're not married. Why are divorce rates down? It's because nobody's getting married in the first place. And when I say nobody, I'm barely exaggerating. I mean, the number of weddings that you see in churches now is almost nothing compared to what it used to be. Nobody bothers to get married. What would the point be? So the same-sex marriage got me going. I was trying to write a scholarly work. Now, the problem with me writing a scholarly work was that I had a 2.9 GPA in high school, which probably impresses somebody here tonight. So I was not a scholar, okay? But what I can do is tell stories. I'm a pretty good storyteller. I'm a really lousy scholar, so I just turned it all into a novel. So this is a novel intended to try to explain what marriage is. So what is the definition of marriage? Now, let me first of all give you the legal definition of marriage. Of course, as a lawyer, we only deal with statutes and case law. That's how you get legal definitions of anything. Well, in the state of Kentucky, we never had a definition of marriage in our statutes. And you never had one in Illinois either. In 1998 is the first time that marriage was ever defined in a statute. The reason for that is you also do not define in a statute the color blue. Buck's wearing a blue shirt. How would you describe blue? Your pastor's wearing a green shirt. How do you describe green? You don't need to describe green. Green is green, blue is blue, red is red. Marriage is marriage. What is marriage? Well, it's not defined in a statute. We just thought we knew what it was, right? And so, but in the late 90s, we decided that we needed to define marriage in a statute to make sure that everybody knew it was between a man and a woman. And so legislatures all over the country did this. And it just so happens I was in the legislature in Kentucky when we wrote the definition of marriage for Kentucky. Let me read it to you. I had to go on the old statutes today and find this. I hope I can find it. Y'all got, are we on the web here? Let me see. I hope I can find this. Hang on. Jeez, I may need my glasses. Oh my, I'm messing up already. Let me see if I can find it. Hang on. Google, okay, here we go. Google, 402. I know my little wife, I love her. She's dying right now though because when I'm dying, she's dying. Okay. Well, the internet's not working for me right now. I'll find it in a minute. What's your password here? Is it Jesus? Well, let me try to find it before we get done. But here's the point. We came up with this definition of marriage that is absolutely pure nonsense. It's nothing anybody would ever read at a wedding. It's talking about some kind of civil relationship, and it's talking about contracts between people of differing sexes, but that's all it says. It's absolutely legal jumbo. And after I read that, I had been a judge for 10 years before I had ever read the definition of marriage. I had been a judge in family court before I had ever read that. And I looked at it, and it said that we'd passed this in 1998. And I remembered 1998. I was a senator in 1998. In fact, I was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in 1998. So what it means is I'm the guy that wrote it. I kept thinking, who's the idiot that wrote this law? It turns out it was me. So this is how much nonsense there were. See if you can find KRS 402.005. If you Google that in there, we'll come up with it. So legally, there was no great definition of marriage. The Supreme Court of the United States had never defined marriage. The closest thing that you can get to it comes from a case in 1887, and by the way, Maynard versus Hill, this is sounding like law school now, but in this case, Maynard versus Hill, in those days, in the 1800s, it was almost impossible to get a divorce. To get a divorce in most states in the 1800s, you had to get the legislature to pass a bill to allow you to get a divorce. You didn't just go to court and have some judge divorce you. You couldn't do it that way. You literally had to go to your state capital and lobby the legislature and the governor to divorce you. So in 1887, a Supreme Court of the United States case said that marriage is creating the most important relation in life, as having more to do with the morals and civilization of a people than any other institution. It has always been subject to the control of the legislature. That body prescribes the age at which parties may contract to marry, the procedure of form essential to constitute marriage, the duties and obligations it creates, its effects upon the property rights of both, and the acts which may constitute grounds for dissolution. It's a social relation like that of parent and child, the obligations of which arise not from the consent of concurring minds, but are the creation of the law itself, a relation most important as affecting the happiness of individuals. The first step, listen to this, the first step from barbarism to incipient civilization, the purest tie of social life and the true basis of human progress. That was written by a Supreme Court justice over 100 years ago. And it's just saying marriage is the fiber of our nation, the fiber of our country. You found it? 402.005? Oh, man, my law. It's good to have a law clerk. There you go. So here's the definition of marriage in Kentucky. Hey, thank you. Whew, man. As used and recognized in the law of the commonwealth, marriage, which is in quotes for some reason, refers only to the civil status, condition, or relation of one man and one woman united in law for life, for the discharge to each other in the community of the duties legally incumbent upon those whose association is founded on the distinction of sex. You want me to read that again? You don't want me to read it again. It's nonsense. Have you ever been to a wedding where somebody stood up in front of the preacher and says, do you agree to only refer to the civil state? I mean, it's nonsense. And it's because we didn't know what marriage is, or it was, or ever has been. We have no idea what marriage is. We just knew that it should be between a man and a woman. So the bottom line is, any kind of legal definition of marriage is nuts. So how about the Bible? What does the Bible say about marriage? There's not a great definition of marriage in the Bible either. However, the entire marriage is more important than you may think it is, because Genesis to Revelation, and I'm not going to go through it all, is all about a marriage. Jesus' first miracle was at Cana in a wedding, Cana of Galilee. It was at a wedding. When you get into the New Testament, John, they said, "Who are you, John the Baptist?" And John the Baptist says, "I'm just the best man at a wedding." The groom here, pointing to Jesus, is the guy you need to be paying attention to. It starts from Genesis and Adam and Eve, of course, and makes us all the way to Revelation, where we're told that we are the bride of Christ. And so all of the Bible points to a marriage, the marriage supper of the Lamb, which we're all going to experience someday. And then, of course, there is so much. My favorite verse that I found as I was researching and trying to write this book was Hebrews 11:7. It says that Noah, it's all about Noah. Noah, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. Noah, in holy fear, did not build an ark to save the whole world. He built his ark to save his family. There's a little boy in the story that's the hero of the book, really, in many ways, and I named him Noah for that reason. And so family court helped me understand some stuff about God, and that's what I want to pause for a moment and try to help you understand, maybe, that there are three or four primary ways to think about God, and the first one, is, which is easy for me as a lawyer, is as a judge. Most people start their relationship with God, and he's my judge. And he has this son named Jesus Christ who came and died on a cross to pay the penalty for all our sins. And yet, so at the end of the day, it's a judicial relationship. Because of Jesus' death on the cross, this judge says, "I'm free now. I'm going to have mercy on you because Jesus paid the penalty for all of your sins." The problem with that is, that's a good place to start, but the problem with that is that the judge, and I've been there, the judge is, standing up real high on top of everybody, looking down. Sorry for stepping on your pew, Pastor. But you're looking down on all these people. And when you have mercy on somebody, I've done it a million times, you say, now, you need to get out of here before I change my mind. And I would say that with a smile on my face. Get on out of here before I change my mind. Wow. That's not the judge that I want to, that's not the God that I want to hang out with. If I know somebody personally, I'm not allowed to be their judge. And so if you have any view this afternoon that God is your judge, you got a long way to go. It's a good place to start, terrible place to finish. The second way of looking at God that's better is that God is my Father. All of these come out in family court because you got to judge. But then God is my Father. Much better because love enters the picture for the first time. But even then, so many people have had a bad father or a bad father experience. Even that sometimes can be negative. There's the love of the Father, but sometimes that love can get crazy in abuse of children. But there's a third way that I began to understand when I began to research the book and get involved in this, and that is God as my husband. The Bible talks about this a lot in Isaiah and all through both the Old and the New Testament. God is not just my judge, not just my Father. This is a hard one for men. Women usually like this, but God is my husband. God is my lover. That's a whole nother ball game. So you have the judicial view of God. You have the familial, the family view of God. And then you have the nuptial view of God, which is a whole nother thing of a deep relationship. And so bottom line is, I was 60 years old and trying to research and trying to write this book when I began for the first time in my life to understand love. And part of this is because I'm a typical man. I hate to say it. Ladies understand this a little bit better than we men do. But I had an experience that actually ended up in the book. People ask me sometimes if the stories in this book are true. Well, I got sued twice and had 4 Judicial Conduct Commission complaints filed against me because of this book. So this is a dangerous book to the culture of today. The only thing I'm saying in this book, by the way, is that marriage is sacred and divorce is too easy. That's all I was saying. You can boil it down to that sentence. Marriage is sacred, divorce is simply too easy. It has to happen sometimes, but it's too easy. Well, that made people's heads explode. But one of the stories that I tell in the book actually happened to me in India. I was there with Guna Kumar a few years ago. And one of the things that happened to me being a judge in family court, I felt guilty about not going to weddings. I had not been to a wedding in over 20 years. I refused to go to weddings because they were always on Saturdays when I'd rather play golf. I just didn't like weddings. And so I began to realize, though, that weddings were more important than I thought they were. And so I was invited to come to India to help actually preach a sermon at Guna's daughter's wedding. Sue and I went there, and it was awesome. We got to be with Guna's daughter, Persis, and her husband-to-be, Stephen. We were in the room when they came together about an hour before the wedding, and they had only seen each other one time. The marriage was arranged. They had seen each other one time, had a conversation that lasted 3 minutes. Now they're seeing each other for the second time an hour before the wedding. And it was so cute because when we were with Persis and her family, and here came Stephen, he came walking in, and you could tell Persis was just looking at him and like looked him up and down. And you looked at Stephen and he was like, And you could tell they both were saying, he'll do just fine. She'll do just fine. And they got 2 beautiful kids now, by the way. It works. That system works fairly well. But the bottom line is, after the wedding, I was invited to go to a little country church. I don't think Sue went with me that day. No, I don't think you did. I was they talked me into going out and preaching at this little rural church. And so I did. There was about 50 people there. I was giving them a little short little sermon. We had a bunch of children there that day who had diseases and all kinds of issues. There were six or seven ladies in the back who we call them destitute ladies. They were saved off the streets with HIV, blind, all kinds of problems. And then there were some village people on this side, I remember. And Getsy, this nice lady, was interpreting for me, and I was about 10 minutes into my sermon when this lady comes up and stands right in front of me, pulls her shawl up over her head, which means she's ready for me to pray for her. So, Rob, I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes you don't have to give an altar call. They just come down anyway. This happens in India quite a bit. They're like, we've heard enough of you. We're ready for you to pray. And so they had heard enough of me, and they were ready just for me to pray for them. And so I wrapped up my sermon very quickly. And I went to the back, and Getsy told me they're expecting you to pray for them. So I went to the back. These ladies were all weeping with tears. So I laid my hands on one lady, and I'm praying for her. Lord, I don't know what she needs, but be with this sweet, wonderful lady. Getsy got distracted with some children. And she was away, so now I had no interpreter, so I'm stuck there by myself with these ladies. And I'm telling you, this is a true story. By the third lady, I said, Lord, they didn't know this, but I stopped praying for them. And I started praying for me. And I was saying, Lord, you know, I've followed you all over the world. I'm pretty good about trusting you. I'm pretty good about obeying you. I'm pretty good about following you, but I know absolutely nothing about loving you. These ladies love you. They've got something I don't have. They're blind. They've got HIV. They're pitiful. They've got something I don't have. Oh, Jesus, please, would you give me just a little bit of whatever they got? I mean, I was 60 years old. It was awesome. And I walked out of there that day a different man because I got just a little bit. How much love did I get that day? Not much, but I got a little bit. I began to understand a little bit. These ladies actually were married to God in their own way. They understand the love of God. So I started, anyway, that story ends up in my book. Because at the end of the day, marriage is not about the kind of love that the world is talking about. You know, when same-sex marriage became legal, the White House had the rainbow colors. Do y'all remember this? 2015. And the President of the United States tweeted out, love is love. L-U-V is L-U-V. Love is love. And so everybody really believes that marriage has something to do with our definition of love. It's actually got nothing to do with our definition of love. It's so much deeper than that. It's supposed to be something that's pointing us to God Himself. So what is marriage? Well, the Bible has a couple other things that are worth talking about. One is, I named the judge's mother. The judge, by the way, is named Judge Zenas. Atticus Zenas. I use the word Zenas, the name Zenas, because Titus 3:13 says that Paul was talking to Titus. He says, do everything you can to help Zenas the lawyer. It's the only place in the Bible where the word lawyer is used. And his name was Zenas. So I named the judge Zenas. But the judge grew up in a little Methodist church, not much different than the one probably in Sidell, Illinois, a little country church in Sadieville, Kentucky, and I'd use Sadieville, Kentucky because my dad had pastored a church in Sadieville, Kentucky in 1950. And his mother's name was Beulah, and I named her Beulah on purpose. Y'all know Beulah Land? There's a couple of songs. Beulah Land. You can probably play Beulah Land, can't you? Maybe. Maybe we can close tonight with Beulah Land. Maybe. Can you fake it? Beulah Land, I'm dreaming of you. Anyway, there's two versions. But everybody thinks that Beulah Land is heaven. The people that write these songs, they think Beulah Land is heaven. It's not heaven. Beulah Land comes from Pilgrim's Progress, written in 1678 by John Bunyan from prison. He was in prison for preaching without a license, by the way. I would have been arrested. And the story of Pilgrim's Progress, you have to read Pilgrim's Progress, goes from the city of destruction, and a guy named Christian is trying to make his way to the celestial city. Do you remember the story? He goes through all these trials and tribulations, and he's close to heaven, but there's this river between called death. You have to go through the river of death to get to the city, the celestial city, to heaven. And just on the other side of the river is this place called Beulah Land. Beulah Land is where it was just like today, a San Diego day. The birds are singing. The temperature is perfect. The grass is green. The sky is blue. It's the perfect day. Everybody's happy there. The animals seem happy. Everybody's so happy in Beulah Land. And it's from Beulah Land you go into the river and across to the celestial city. And if from Beulah Land, you're not in heaven, but you can see heaven. Do you know what the word Beulah means? It's only found one time in the Bible, Isaiah 62, 7 and 8. Beulah means married. It's not heaven. It's married. And so there's a lot you can say about that, one of which is, it helps to be married if you want to go to heaven. Right, Larry? I mean, honestly, would you be sitting there today as a saved and sanctified man full of the Holy Spirit if you hadn't had a wife to sort of lead you and guide you in the right direction? Push you. I didn't want to say it, but. And again, if you're divorced, don't feel guilty. If you're single, don't feel sad. I'm just telling you, marriage is way more important than you think it is. Would I be here tonight if it wasn't for Sue? No. Did she save me? Well, no, not really, but sort of. My dad was a horrible, terrible alcoholic. My mother found the Lord in 1942, while my dad, who was a Marine, was in the South Pacific. He went to a little Methodist church, found Jesus, and when he came back after 3.5 years in the war, my dad came back and there was a new wife in his house. Instead of being his little party girl, she was his little Christian girl. And she cooked up a plan to get my dad to Asbury College. And they enrolled in Asbury College in their mid-30s. And my dad met Jesus about two months after they got there, got gloriously saved, and started preaching every day then for the rest of his life. Why? Because my mother was pushing him. My mother was there as an influence on him. I wouldn't be here today. I would not be here today if not for the love of my mother. Not just for God, but for the love of my mother for my dad. They were told they would never have any kids. And so in June of 1950, they graduated from Asbury College. My mother was 37 years old when she graduated from college. And in March of 1951, Timmy was born. They celebrated graduating college by making me. I love that story. And my little brother Danny came along later. Beulah Land. Beulah means married. Marriage has something to do with your salvation. I mean, you can't get to the celestial city unless you're married. And of course, God ultimately wants us to be married to Him. Now, I'm sorry I'm preaching a little bit more than I planned on it. So I'm going to stop here and shift gears slightly and just say, my book was about the fact that marriage, and again, as you can tell, I'm not giving y'all any tips on how to be a better husband. My wife would laugh at me if I did that. I'm not giving you ladies any tips on how to love your man. I don't know anything about that. All I'm saying is, your marriage is more important than you think it is. I mean, I know from conversation with people, sometimes I'll say, well, I've been married for over 50 years, and people go, wow, really? Yeah. People are amazed. It's the greatest witness I have in my life. Is the simple fact that I've been married for over 50 years. They'll always say, to one woman? Yeah, one woman. How did that happen? I say this, I've started marrying a few people now, okay? So I didn't do it. Like I said, I boycotted weddings. I went to India. That trip changed my life. I came home. I not only started attending weddings, but I started to marry people. And when I'm asked to marry somebody now, the first thing I say to them is, first of all, thank you for getting married. Even people that don't know God, they're not Christians at all, but I just say, hey, thank you for getting married. You're doing the world a favor right now just by getting married. It's such a rare thing. So what about divorce then? Where does divorce fit into all this? I'll close with some comments about that. As I said, in the old days, you had to go to the legislature to even get a divorce. The book is entitled Judge Z, Irretrievably Broken. So let me give you a little insider information into family court. I would say raise your hand if you've ever been there before, but it might embarrass somebody. But irretrievably broken are magic words in a divorce case in Kentucky, and it would be something similar in Illinois. I should have researched this. But to get a divorce in Kentucky, you have to prove that your marriage is irretrievably broken. Those are words from the statute. And so when you have a hearing for a divorce case, the judge is supposed to ask two questions. The first question is your marriage irretrievably broken? And you say yes. Second question is there any reasonable prospect of reconciliation? I'm not supposed to divorce you if there's a reasonable prospect of reconciliation. And so after 10 years, and I read this statute, I knew the statute was there, but I had literally ignored it the whole time I was a judge. I realized that there was not a single judge in the state of Kentucky who was actually having any kind of a hearing to ask those questions. We were just routinely checking the boxes and filling out the paperwork and signing the orders, and off you go. But as I began to research the book, like I say, I never intended it to be an anti-divorce book. I was trying to say marriage is sacred, marriage is important. And as I began to research all of this, though, I thought, man, divorce is way too easy. Nobody's doing this the right way, because the statute in Kentucky said this, and I'm going to quote it. The court shall, okay, when you're a lawyer, the word shall is very important. The court shall, after a hearing, that means the judge is supposed to have a hearing. The court shall, after a hearing, make a finding whether or not the marriage is irretrievably broken. I read that with new eyes, and I thought, the judge is supposed to, first of all, decide is the marriage irretrievably broken before he does anything. And I realized I had never done that. And I started checking around, and it turns out there was not a single judge in Kentucky had done that in the last 30 years. The hearing that's required in our statute was not being done by anybody. And so I'm mulling through this, and I've got a little Chinese couple in there getting a divorce. No lawyers. He was a professor at the University of Kentucky. His little wife was sitting over there, and she barely spoke English. And I'm trying to have this quickie divorce with him. And I said, is your marriage irretrievably broken? He said, yes. I said, is there any reasonable prospect of reconciliation? He said, no. I turned to the wife. I said, do you agree? I could tell she barely spoke English. So I spoke very slowly. And I says, is your marriage irretrievably broken? And she says to me, this little 30-year-old Chinese lady, what does that mean? Okay, I'm sitting there. I've been a lawyer for almost 30 years at that time. I've been a judge for almost 10 years in family court. I've divorced 1,000 people. And I don't know the answer to that question. That's the day for sure I decided to write this book. I did not know the answer, because the bottom line is I decided to start having a serious hearing in every case. And in those hearings, I would have what I called an IBH, an irretrievably broken hearing. Before I would decide anything about the children, before I would decide anything about the property, I had a 15-minute hearing in every case to make sure that the marriage was really irretrievably broken. And those words are important. Irretrievably broken. My goodness, I mean, if you drop a vase and it's in smithereens, it's irretrievably broken. But if you break a leg, it'll heal back. I mean, if I hit my ball in the rough and I lose my ball in the rough, somebody's probably going to find it. So it's not irretrievably lost. But if I hit it in the Pacific Ocean, it's probably irretrievably lost. So what does it mean to be irretrievably broken? I mean, we know it's broken because here we are. We're sitting here in divorce court. So something's not right. But is it possible that somehow this marriage can be saved for the sake of the children, for the sake of yourselves? So I started having these hearings, and I would say, is your marriage irretrievably broken? Yes. Any reasonable prospect of reconciliation? No. I would just simply add one question to that. Tell me why. That's all I did. Oh, man. They just stared at me. And by the way, the lawyers, their heads were starting to explode by now. They had never seen this kind of hearing in their life. In fact, not only was I the only person in Kentucky doing it, I don't have time to explain it all, but I was the only person in the United States that was doing this. And so they gave me all these answers, why it's irretrievably broken. 2/3 of the time, they had a good answer. 1/3 of the time, it was kind of a weak answer. Well, we're just really different. Oh, really? No kidding. The best definition of marriage, by the way, is from Dr. Dennis Kinlaw, my mentor, who says that for him, marriage is a union of differences. And I would quote that to people. I said, you know, being different is really not a reason to get divorced. Being different is a reason to get married. Oh, we're just not in love anymore. We've grown apart. Oh, I don't know how many times I heard that. We've grown apart. We've grown apart. So you hear all these little flimsy answers. But I would say, and then I would say, when they had children, what do your kids think about this? That's when the tears would start to come. I almost never had a hearing when somebody didn't cry. 95 times out of 100, the answer was they hate it. They would pause for a moment and realize that they had given me a bad answer. And they would say then, but they're adjusting. And I would say to these dads, so tell me what's your agreement on the time sharing. Oh, I'm going to have them every other weekend. I'd say, sir, really? Are you actually satisfied with every other weekend? Well, not really. Are you sure? And so I told everybody that what I was doing in this hearing was, I'm taking your divorce. Divorce right now, by the way, in the state of Illinois, I don't know what it is. I should have researched it. But you can get a divorce like this. It is so fast, right? I don't know what your law is. In Kentucky, even with children, 60 days. Wake up one morning and decide you don't like her anymore. 60 days later, man, it's all over. I would tell people, all I'm doing with this hearing is I'm taking your divorce off the interstate that has no speed limits. In Germany, they have an Autobahn with no speed limit. I'm taking your divorce off the Autobahn, and I'm going to run it through the neighborhood with a couple of speed bumps. And in the neighborhood, this hearing that we're having is a little speed bump along the way. And there's a sign in the neighborhood that says, "Beware children at play." So we're just going to slow your divorce down. We're not actually going to refuse to divorce you. Now I'm going to finish with this. And I'm so thrilled tonight with this because it's sort of right on point, but it's sort of not right on point too. But it's happened this week. This has been one of the greatest weeks of my life. What is this, Friday? Is this Friday? Okay. My partner in this whole project about irretrievably broken hearings was a PhD from the University of Minnesota. A Unitarian Universalist. Y'all understand what that means? But he had written a lot of very important books about divorce. He had done national research. He's the guy whose research showed that one-third of every single couple in divorce court, at least one of the parties wishes it wasn't happening. That at least one of the parties, if you gave them a voice, would say, "I don't want this to happen." And so he was a very pro-marriage, anti-divorce, secular PhD who was very famous in America. I read several of his books. And so one day I called him. I said, "Dr. Daugherty," I found him on the phone, "I'm a judge in Kentucky. Let me tell you what I'm doing. I'm writing this book. Would you help me?" Well, he seemed thrilled to talk to me, thrilled that I was interested in his research. He told me I was the first judge who had ever called him. He had a whole project about trying to slow down divorces so that people could have time to get counseling and sometimes be reconciled. A wonderful thing. He came to Kentucky a couple of times to talk to meetings that I conducted. But he made it very clear the whole time that we were interacting with each other that he was a Unitarian Universalist. And he knew that I was kind of a conservative evangelical Christian. And he knew that, and he appreciated me at a certain level, and I appreciated his intellect. But 2 years ago, or actually last summer, I'm going to read this to you. Bill Daugherty is his name, Minnesota. I wrote another book last year, okay? It had nothing to do with marriage. It's a golf book. Got any golfers here? I'd rather be golfing right now, but anyway, not really. Hang on. You really like my golf book. So I sent him my book. We had had a few conversations about politics. He was on this side and I was on this side, and we had some difficult conversations. But we agreed that marriage was sacred in a way, important. I guess the way he would say it is, I'm not going to say it's sacred, but it's important. And divorce was too easy. So I sent him my latest book last summer. "Bill, Bill, here's my latest book. I'm hoping not to get sued this time." He knew I'd been sued twice and had 4 Judicial Conduct Commission complaints. So I was making a little joke. He writes me back, "Congratulations, Tim." This is in July of last summer. "The book looks great. My life has taken a turn you will feel good about. I'm trying to be a follower of Jesus." Wow. Bill. I wrote him back. I said, "Me too, brother." "Nowhere else to go. Love you, Tim Philpott." So Tuesday of this week, I wrote him another text. "Dear Bill, I'm going to be in Minneapolis speaking on September 19. I'm coming in early. So is there a time Sunday evening or Monday when I could buy you lunch, dinner, or breakfast and just catch up?" He writes me back and says, "Not sorry, I'm going to be out of town." He said, "However, I will email you a link to an interview at my church on my return to Jesus and how that ties into my work." He then sent me an email explaining that the time that we spent together was one of the factors. One of the factors in his return to Jesus. This guy's 78 years old. He came to Jesus at age 77. I watched the interview. He was interviewed just last Sunday at some mega church in Minneapolis. Sue watched it. He said some things that were just amazing to me. And I began to realize that writing this book, I said this for a long time. I don't know that my book is any good, but I know that I'm on the right subject. That's the way I said it. I'm not sure my book's very good, but I'm on the right subject, because when you start to talk about marriage, all sorts of doors open up to conversation about God. It's because God is our husband. He's not just our judge. He's our husband. He's our lover. And these conversations have just opened up. So Bill is being interviewed by his pastor up there about how he has come to Jesus at age 77. Clearest testimony you've ever heard. And he said, well, he says, first of all, as a Unitarian Universalist, he says, I just got tired trying to make up my own religion. He says, we get to just decide whatever we want to do. And he says, I got tired of trying to figure it out. And then he said, the other thing has been important for me is that I always was asking this God who I had created in my mind to tell me whether or not Jesus was who he said he was. And I realized I had it backward. And he says, I realized I needed to follow Jesus. He said, Jesus never told us what to believe, and Jesus never told us how to behave. Jesus simply said, follow me. He used those words. Man, he was repeating stuff we had talked about a million times. Jesus never told us what to believe, and Jesus never told us how to behave. Jesus just says, hey, you're probably never going to figure it out, so just follow me. And he says, I began to follow Jesus, and I decided I would let Jesus explain God to me instead of the other way around. I thought, man, that's brilliant right there. That is profound right there. So I'm breathless almost. I'm even, this just happened. So I'm a little bit emotional at the moment, because it's possible. Everybody, you know, I used to get all of my criticism for these hearings I was having. People would say, well, do you know of any marriages you actually saved? I'm going, well, not really. Because who knows? Even if the divorce ended and we saved the marriage today, maybe they got divorced 5 years later. Maybe, I don't know exactly. There was a few, I've got some stories I could tell you. But I don't know for sure that I saved any marriages with this book. But here's what's hit me this week. Here's what I do know for sure. I met Bill Daugherty, a PhD at the University of Minnesota. 6 years ago, 7 years ago. And somehow Bill Daugherty's going to make it to heaven, because we started discussing marriage. Beulah Land. It's not heaven, but you can see heaven from there. So let's do this. Would you all stand? I've talked long enough. It's 7:30. Honey, come up here. Let's do this. I'm going to ask my wife to come up. Hey, let's stand in a circle. This may be logistically slightly complicated, but everybody, let's try to get in a circle as we close this evening. I don't know if we have only married couples here or not. I don't know who's here. Seems like almost everybody's coupled up. I don't know who's who around here. Close enough, yeah. Man, Robin, you got some great people here. Yeah. And I'm sure that lady to your right's a great person too, although we haven't met. What's your name?
Liana.
Liana, yeah. Wow. You all are blessed to be in Fairmount, Illinois. This is way better than Hollywood or even San Diego. So, just... if you're holding your wife's hand or your husband's hand, just grip it real tight right now and be thankful for your spouse. Husbands, that lady whose hand you're holding right now, she's saving you. Jesus is your salvation, but she has been saving you for a long time, right? And marriage itself is saving you. I mean, every man in this room knows what I'm talking about right now, because on our own, think about what'd you say the other day? No good, rotten bum? Isn't that what you called me? Yeah. Larry laughs because I call myself a no good, rotten bum, but that's what I am without this lady and Jesus. That's what I am. So marriage, Beulah land. You got to go through Beulah land and through the river to get to the celestial city. And I believe that that's where God wants us all to be. I hope and pray that God is not just your judge. I hope and pray that he is not just your father, even, as good as that is. I hope and pray that God himself is your lover, your husband. We are the bride of Christ. There's going to be a great wedding ceremony, the wedding supper of the Lamb. God sent his only Son, Jesus Christ, to this earth to be a lamb, to suffer and die for us, to give us life. What a great plan of salvation that was. What a great plan of salvation it was as well to create in the Garden of Eden a man and a woman. Oh my. How great was that? God looked at man and said, I can do better. I can do better. And he created the woman out of the rib. The bride of Christ was born that day. So Jesus, we thank you for being our Savior, but we thank you too for giving us our wife, our husband, to go through this life. Life is difficult alone. God puts the lonely in families. We thank you for our families tonight. Thank you for not leaving us alone. If there's anybody around this circle tonight who's lonely, if there's anybody around the circle tonight that feels lonely, I pray they would reach their hearts out to you right now and say, oh God, please come into my heart in a new, a fresh way. Teach me what it is to love you. Teach me what it is to accept the love of this heavenly Father, this heavenly husband who loves us so much. So Lord, teach us what it means to love you. Thank you for the circle of friends here tonight. What a wonderful church. What a wonderful place to be. I just give you thanks for the people of Fairmount, Illinois, Sidell, Illinois, that love you so much. They are bright, shining stars in the universe. Bright, shining stars in the universe here in Illinois. Lord, thank you for them. Thank you that we can connect with them. In Jesus' name.